official on it. Let's just say that the leak in the papers came from a higher security clearance than I have. Top secret? Press? Both men laughed. Something like that. The story had information that I haven't seen, Tolan said, speaking the truth, mostly. The fire was out, and people in his department had been speculating on how Ivan had put it out so fast. Shouldn't hurt them too bad. I mean, they don't have millions of people taking to the road on summer vacations, do they? Not hardly. How's the cake? Not bad. Tolan smiled, already wondering if he needed the extra time on the bike. Moscow, RSFSR. The Politburo reconvened at 9:30 the next morning. The sky outside the double-paned windows was gray and curtained with the heavy snow that was beginning to fall again, adding to the half-meter already on the ground. There would be sledding tonight on the hills of Gorky Park, Sergeyev thought. The snow would be cleared off the two frozen lakes for skating under the lights to the music of Tchaikovsky and Prokofiev. Moscovites would laugh and drink their vodka and savor the cold, blissfully ignorant of what was about to be said here, of the turns that all of their lives would take. The main body of the Politburo had adjourned at 4 the previous afternoon, and then the 5 men who made up the Defense Council had met alone. Not even all of the full Politburo members were privy to that decision-making body. Overseeing them at the far end of the room was a full-length portrait of Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, Lenin, the revolutionary saint of Soviet communism, his domed forehead thrown back as though in a fresh breeze, his piercing eyes looking off toward the glorious future which his stern face confidently proclaimed, which the science of Marxism-Leninism called an historic inevitability. A glorious future. Which future? Sergeyev asked himself. What has become of our revolution? What has become of our party? Did Comrade Ilyich really mean it to be like this? Sergeyev looked at the General Secretary, the young man, supposed by the West to be fully in charge, the man who was even now changing things. His accession to the highest post in the party had been a surprise to some, Sergeyev among them. The West still looked to him as hopefully as we once had, Sergeyev thought. His own arrival in Moscow had changed that rapidly enough. Yet another broken dream. The man who had put a happy face on years of agricultural failure now applied his superficial charm to a larger arena. He was laboring mightily. Anyone at this table would admit that. But his task was an impossible one. To get here, he had been forced to make too many promises, too many deals with the old guard. Even the young men of 50 and 60 he'd added to the Politburo had their own ties to former regimes. Nothing had really changed. The West never seemed to absorb the idea. Not since Khrushchev had one man held sway. One man rule held dangers vividly remembered by the older generation of the party. The younger men had heard the tales of the great purges under Stalin often enough to take the lesson to heart, and the army had its own institutional memory of what Khrushchev had done to its hierarchy. In the Politburo, as in the jungle, the only rule was survival, and for all, collective safety lay in collective rule. Because of this, the men selected for the titular post of General Secretary were not elected so much for their personal dynamism as for their experience in the party, an organization that did not reward people for standing out too distinctly from the crowd. Like Brezhnev and Andropov and Chernenko, the current chief of the party lacked the power of personality to dominate this room with his will alone. He'd had to compromise to be in his chair, and he would have to compromise to remain there. The real power blocks were amorphous things, relationships among men, loyalties that changed with circumstance and knew only expediency. The real power lay within the party itself. The party ruled all, but the party was no longer the expression of one man. It had become a collection of interests represented here by 12 other men. Defense had its interest, the KGB, and heavy industry, and even agriculture. Each interest held its own brand of power, and the chief of each allied himself with others in order to secure his own place. The general secretary would try to change this, would gradually appoint men loyal to himself to the posts that death made vacant. Would he then learn, as his predecessors had, that loyalty so easily died around this table? For now he still carried the burden of his own compromises. With his own men not yet fully in place, the general secretary was only the foremost member of a group that could unseat him as easily as it had unseated Khrushchev. What would the West say if it learned that the dynamic general secretary mainly served as executor for the decisions of others? Even now he did not speak first. "Comrades," began the defense minister, "the Soviet Union must have oil, at least 200 million tons more than we can produce. Such oil exists only a few hundred kilometers from our border in the Persian Gulf. More oil than we will ever need. We have the ability to take it, of course. Inside of 2 weeks, we could assemble enough aircraft and airborne troops to swoop down on those oil fields and gobble them up. Unfortunately, there could not fail to be a violent Western response. Those same oil fields supply Western Europe, Japan, and, to a lesser extent, America. The NATO countries do not have the ability to defend those fields with conventional means. The Americans have their rapid deployment force, a hollow shell of headquarters, and a few light troops. Even with their pre-positioned equipment at Diego Garcia, they could not hope to stop our airborne and mechanized forces. Were they to try, and they would have to try, their elite troops would be overwhelmed and exterminated in a few days. And they would be faced with a single alternative: nuclear weapons. This is a real risk that we cannot disregard. We know for a fact that American war plans call for nuclear weapons in this case. Such weapons are stored in quantity at Diego Garcia, and would almost certainly be used. Therefore, before we can seize the Persian Gulf, we must first do one other thing. We must eliminate NATO as a political and military force." Sergeyev sat upright in his leather chair. What was this? What was he saying? He struggled to keep his face impassive as the defense minister continued. "If NATO is first removed from the board, America will be in a most curious position. The United States will be able to meet its own energy needs from Western Hemisphere sources, removing the need to defend the Arab states, who are in any case not terribly popular with the American Jewish Zionist community."
Did they really believe this? Sergeyev wondered. Did they actually believe the United States would sit on its hands? What went on at the late meeting yesterday?
At last one other person shared his concern. "So the only thing we have to do is conquer Western Europe, comrade?" a candidate member asked. "Are these not the countries against whose conventional forces you warn us every year? Every year you tell us of the threat the massed NATO armies present to us. And now you say casually that we must conquer them? Excuse me, comrade defense minister, but do not France and England have their own nuclear arsenals? And why would America not fulfill its treaty promise to use nuclear weapons in the defense of NATO?" Sergeyev was surprised that a junior member had put the issues so quickly on the table. He was more surprised that the foreign minister answered. So, another piece of the puzzle. But what did the KGB think of this? Why were they not represented here?
The chairman was recovering from surgery, but there should have been someone here, unless that had been taken care of last night. Our objectives must be limited, and obviously so. This presents us with several political tasks. First, we must engender a feeling of security in America, to put them off guard until it is too late for them to react forcefully. Second, we must attempt to unravel the NATO alliance in a political sense. The foreign minister ventured a rare smile. As you know, the KGB has been working on such a plan for the past several years. It is now in its final form. I will outline it for you. He did so, and Sergeyev nodded at its audacity, and also with a new understanding of the power balance in this room. So, it was the KGB. He should have known. But would the rest of the Politburo fall in line? The minister went on. You see how it would work. One piece after another would fall into place. Given these preconditions, the waters so thoroughly muddied, and the fact that we would proclaim our unwillingness to threaten directly the two independent NATO nuclear powers, we feel that the nuclear risk, while real, is less than the risk that we already face in our economy. Sergeyev leaned back in his leather chair. So, there it was. War was less risky than a cold, hungry peace. It had been decided. Or had it? Might some combination of other Politburo members have the power or prestige to reverse that decision? Could he dare to speak out against this madness? Perhaps a judicious question first. Do we have the ability to defeat NATO? He was chilled by the glib reply. Of course, Defense answered. What do you think we have an army for? We have already consulted with our senior commanders. And when you asked us last month for more steel, for more new tanks, Comrade Defense Minister, was your excuse that NATO was too weak? Sergeyev asked himself angrily. What machinations had taken place? Have they even spoken with their military advisers yet? Or had the Defense Minister exploited his vaunted personal expertise? Had the General Secretary allowed himself to be bullied by Defense? And by the Foreign Minister? Had he even objected? Was this how the decisions were made to decide the fate of nations? What would Vladimir Ilyich have thought of this?
Comrades, this is madness, said Pyotr Bromkovsky.
The oldest man there, frail and past 80, his conversation occasionally rambled about the idealistic times long before, when Communist Party members really believed that they were the leading wave of history. The Yezhovshchina purges had ended that.
Yes, we have a grave economic danger. Yes, we have a grave danger to the security of the state. But do we replace this with a greater danger? Consider what can happen. How long, Comrade Defense Minister, before you can initiate your conquest of NATO?
I am assured that we can have our army fully ready for combat operations in 4 months.
4 months. I presume that we will have fuel 4 months from now. Enough fuel to begin a war.
Petya was old, but no one's fool. Comrade Sergeyev. The General Secretary gestured down the table, dodging his responsibility yet again. Which side to take? The young candidate member made a swift decision. Inventories of light fuels, gasoline, diesel, etc., are high at the moment, Sergeyev had to admit. We always use the cold weather months, the time when usage of these fuels is lowest, to build up our stocks, and added to this are our strategic defense reserves. Enough for 45...
60,
insisted the defense minister. 45 days is a more realistic figure, comrade. Sergeyev held his position. My department has studied fuel consumption by military units as part of a program to increase the strategic fuel reserves, something neglected in past years. With savings in other consumption and certain industrial sacrifices, we might expand this to 60 days of war stocks, perhaps even 70, plus giving you other stocks to expand training exercises. The near-term economic costs would be slight, but by midsummer this would change rapidly. Sergeyev paused, greatly disturbed at how easily he had gone along with the unspoken decision. "I have sold my soul. Or have I acted like a patriot? Have I become like the other men around this table? Or have I merely told the truth? And what is truth?" All he could be certain of, he told himself, is that he had survived. For now. "We do have the limited ability, as I told you yesterday, to restructure our distillate production. In this case, my staff feels that a 9% increase in the militarily important fuels can be accomplished, based on our reduced production. I caution, however, that my staff analysts also feel that all existing estimates of fuel usage in combat conditions are grossly optimistic." A last feeble attempt at protest. "Give us the fuel, Mikhail Eduardovich," the defense minister smiled coldly, "and we'll see it is properly used. My analysts estimate that we can accomplish our goals in 2 weeks, perhaps less. But I will grant you the strength of the NATO armies and double our estimates to 30 days. We will still have more than enough."
"And what if NATO discovers our intentions?" old Petya demanded.
"They will not. Already we are preparing our maskirovka, our trickery. NATO is not a strong alliance. It cannot be. The ministers bicker over each country's defense contribution. Their peoples are divided and soft. They cannot standardize their weapons, and because of it, their supply situation is utter chaos. And their most important, most powerful member is separated from Europe by 5,000 kilometers of ocean. The Soviet Union is only an overnight train ride from the German border. But, Petya, my old friend, I will answer your question. If everything fails and our intentions are discovered, we can always stop, say that we were running an exercise, and return to peacetime conditions, and be no worse off than if we do nothing at all. We need strike only if all is ready. We can always draw back." Everyone at the table knew that was a lie, though a clever one, because no one had the courage to denounce it as such. What army had ever been mobilized to be called back? No one else spoke up to oppose the defense minister. Bromkovsky rambled on for a few minutes, quoting Lenin's stricture about endangering the home of world socialism. But even that drew no response. The danger to the state, actually the danger to the party and the Politburo, was manifest. It could not become graver. The alternative was war. 10 minutes later, the Politburo voted. Sergeyev and his 8 fellow candidate members were mere spectators. The vote was 11-2 for war. The process had begun. Date, time. 2-3-1715, copy 1 of 1 of Soviet report. BC Soviet Report BJT 2310FL. Task confirms oil field fire FL. EDS. Moved in advance for Saturday PMS FL by Patrick Flynn FC. AP Moscow correspondent. Moscow. AP. It was confirmed today by TASS, the Soviet news agency, that a serious fire had taken place in the western Siberian region of the Soviet Union. A back-page article in Pravda, the official Communist Party newspaper, noted the fire, commenting that the heroic fire brigade had saved countless lives by its skill and devotion to duty, also preventing more serious damage to the nearby oil facilities. The fire was reportedly begun by a technical malfunction in the automatic refinery control systems and spread rapidly, but was swiftly extinguished,
not without casualties among the brave men detailed to attack the fire, and the courageous workmen who raced heroically to their comrades' side. Though somewhat at odds with Western reports, the fire in the area did not go out more quickly than had been expected. Western officials are now speculating about a highly sophisticated firefighting system built into the Nizhnevartovsk facility that allowed the Soviets to extinguish the fire. AB, BA, 23-1601, ESTFL, end of story. Chapter 3. Correlation of Forces. Moscow, RSFSR. "They didn't ask me," explained Chief of the General Staff Marshal Shavirin. "They didn't ask for my evaluation. The political decision was already made when they called me in Thursday night. When was the last time the defense minister asked me for a substantive judgmental decision?"
"And what did you say?" asked Marshal Rajkov, commander-in-chief of ground forces.
The initial response was a grim, ironic smile. "That the armed forces of the Soviet Union were able to carry out this task, given 4 months of preparation."
4 months? Rajkov stared out the window. He turned back. "We won't be ready."
"Hostilities will commence on 15 June, Shavirin replied. "We must be ready, Yuri. And what choice did I have? Would you have had me say, 'I am sorry, Comrade General Secretary, but the Soviet Army is unable to carry out this task'? I would have been dismissed and replaced by someone more tractable. You know who my replacement will be. Would you rather answer to Marshal Bukharin?"
"That fool," Rajkov growled.
It had been the then-Lieutenant General Bukharin whose brilliant plan had led the Soviet Army into Afghanistan. Professionally a nonentity, his political connections had not only saved him, but continued his career to near the pinnacle of uniformed power. A clever man, Bukharin. Never involved in the mountain campaigns himself, he could point to his brilliant paper plan and complain that it had been poorly executed, after he had moved on to command of the Kiev military district, historically the shining gate to marshal's rank.
"So, would you have him in this office, dictating your plans to you?" Shavirin asked.
Rajkov shook his head. The two men had been friends and comrades since each had commanded a tank troop in the same regiment, just in time for the final surge toward Vienna in 1945.
"How are we to go about it?" Rajkov asked.
"Red Storm," the marshal replied simply.
Red Storm was the plan for a mechanized attack into West Germany and the Low Countries. Constantly updated for changes in the force structures of both sides, it called for a 2 to 3 week campaign commencing after a rapid escalation of tension between East and West. Despite this, in accordance with standard Soviet strategic doctrine, it called for strategic surprise as a precondition for success, and the use of conventional weapons only.
"At least they aren't talking about atomic arms," Rajkov grunted.
Other plans with other names applied to different scenarios, including many for the use of tactical and even strategic nuclear arms, something no one in uniform wished to contemplate. Despite all the saber-rattling of their political masters, these professional soldiers knew all too well that the use of nuclear arms made only for ghastly uncertainties.
"And the Maskirovka?"
"In two parts. The first is purely political, to work against the United States. The second part, immediately before the war begins, is from KGB. You know it, from KGB Group Nord. We reviewed it 2 years ago."
Rajkov grunted. Group Nord was an ad hoc committee of KGB department chiefs, first assembled by then-chief of the KGB Yuri Andropov in the mid-1970s. Its purpose was to research means of splitting the NATO alliance, and, in general, to conduct political and psychological operations aimed at undermining Western will. Its specific plan to shake the NATO military and political structure in preparation for a shooting war was Nord's proudest example of legerdemain. But would it work? The two senior officers shared an ironic look. Like most professional soldiers, they distrusted spies and all their plans.
4 months, Rajkov repeated. We have much to do. And if this KGB magic fails to work?
It is a good plan. It need only deceive the West for a week, though 2 weeks would be better. The key, of course, is how quickly NATO can reach full readiness. If we can delay the mobilization process 7 days, victory is assured.
And if not? Rajkov asked sharply,
knowing that even a 7-day delay was no guarantee.
Well, then it is not assured, but the balance of forces is on our side. You know that, Yuri.
The option of recalling the mobilized forces had never been discussed with the chief of the general staff.
We will need to improve discipline throughout the force, first of all, Sink Ground said. And I need to inform our senior commanders at once. We need to implement intense training operations.
Just how awful is this fuel problem?
Shavirin handed his subordinate the notes.
It could be worse. We have enough for extended unit training.
Your task is no easy one, Yuri, but 4 months is a long time for this task, is it not?
It wasn't, but there was no point in saying so.
As you say, 4 months to instill fighting discipline. I will have a free hand?
Within limits.
It is one thing to make a private soldier snap to the orders of his sergeant. It might be another for officers conditioned to pushing paper to change into combat leaders.
Rajkov skirted the issue, but his superior received the message clearly enough.
A free hand on both, Yuri. But act carefully for both our sakes.
Rajkov nodded briefly.
He knew whom he'd use to get this done.
With the troops we led 40 years ago, Andrei, we could do this.
Rajkov sat down.
And in truth we have the same raw material now that we had then, and better weapons. The chief unknown remains the men. When we drove our tanks into Vienna, our men were tough, hard veterans.
And so were the SS bastards we crushed.
Shavirin smiled, remembering.
Keep in mind that the same forces are at work in the West, even more so. How well will they fight? Surprised? Divided?
It can work. We must make it work.
I'm meeting with our field commanders Monday. I will tell them myself.
Norfolk, Virginia.
I hope you take good care of it, the mayor said.
It was a moment before Commander Daniel X. McCafferty reacted. USS Chicago had been in commission for only 6 weeks, her completion delayed by a yard fire, and her commissioning ceremony marred by the absence of the mayor of Chicago due to a strike of city workers. Just back from 5 tough weeks of workups in the Atlantic, his crew was now loading provisions for their first operational deployment. McCafferty was still entranced with his new command, and never tired of looking at her. He'd just walked the mayor along the curved upper deck, the first part of any submarine tour, even though there was almost nothing to be seen there.
"Excuse me?"
"Take good care of our ship," said the mayor of Chicago.
"We call them boats, sir, and we'll take good care of her for you.
Will you join us in the wardroom?"
"More ladders."
The mayor pretended to grimace, but McCafferty knew him to be a former fire chief. Would have been useful a few months back, the captain thought.
"Where are you heading tomorrow?"
"To sea, sir." The captain started down the ladder. The mayor of Chicago followed him.
"I figured that."
For a man in his late 50s, he handled the steel ladder easily enough. They met again at the bottom.
"What exactly do you do in these things?"
"Sir, the Navy calls it oceanographic research."
McCafferty led him forward, turning for a smile with his answer to the awkward question. Things were starting quickly for Chicago. The Navy wanted to see just how effective her new quieting systems were. Everything looked good in the acoustical test range off the Bahamas. Now they wanted to see how well things worked in the Barents Sea. The mayor laughed at that one.
"Oh, I suppose you'll be counting the whales for Greenpeace."
"Well, I can say that there are whales where we're heading."
"What's with the tile on your deck? I never heard of rubber decks on a ship."
"It's called anechoic tile, sir. The rubber absorbs sound waves. It makes us quieter to operate and makes it harder to detect us on sonar if somebody pings at us."
"Coffee?"
"You'd think that on a day like this."
The captain chuckled.
"Me too. But it's against regulations." The mayor hoisted his cup and clicked against McCafferty's.
"Luck."
"I'll drink to that."
Moscow, RSFSR. They met at the main officers' club of the Moscow Military District on Ulitsa Krasno-Kazarmanaya, a massively impressive building dating back to Tsarist times. It was the normal time of year for senior field commanders to confer in Moscow, and such events were always punctuated by elaborate ceremonial dinners. Roshkov greeted his fellow officers at the main entrance, and when all were assembled, he led them downstairs to the ornate steam baths. Present were all theater commanders, each accompanied by his deputy, his Air Force commander, and the fleet commanders. A small galaxy of stars, ribbons, and braid. 10 minutes later, naked but for a pair of towels and a handful of birch branches each, they were just another group of middle-aged men, perhaps a bit fitter than was the average in the Soviet Union. They all knew one another. Though many were rivals, they were members of the same profession nevertheless. And with an intimacy characteristic of the Russian steam baths, they exchanged small talk for several minutes. Several of them were grandfathers now, and spoke with animation about the continuation of their lines. Regardless of personal rivalries, it was expected that senior officers would look out for the careers of their comrades' sons. And so information was briefly exchanged on whose son was in which command and wanted advancement to what new posting. Finally came the classically Russian dispute over the strength of the steam. Roshkov peremptorily settled the argument with a thin but steady stream of cold water onto the heated bricks in the center of the room. The resulting hiss would be sufficient to interfere with any listening devices in the room, if the foggy air hadn't already corroded them to junk. Roshkov had not given the first hint of what was happening. Better, he thought, to shock them into the situation and get candid reactions to the situation at hand.
"Comrades, I must make an announcement."
Conversation stilled, and the men looked inquiringly in his direction.
"Here we go.
Comrades, on 15 June of this year, just 4 months from now, we launch an offensive against NATO."
For a moment only the hiss of the steam could be heard. Then three men laughed, having imbibed a few stiff drinks in the sanctity of their staff cars on the drive over from the Kremlin. Those close enough to see Sink Ground's face did not.
"You are serious, Comrade Marshall?" asked the Commander-in-Chief of the Western Theater.
Receiving a nod in reply, he said,
"Then perhaps you will be so kind as to explain the reason for this action."
"Of course.
You are all aware of the Nizhnevartovsk oil field disaster. What you have not yet learned are its strategic and political implications."
It took 6 brisk minutes to outline everything the Politburo had decided. "In just over 4 months from now, we shall launch the most crucial military operation in the history of the Soviet Union. The destruction of NATO as a political and military force. And we will succeed." Finished, he stared at the officer in silence. The steam was having its desired effects on the assembly of flag officers. Its searing heat assaulted their breathing passages, sobering those who had been drinking.
and it made them sweat. They'd be doing a lot of that in the next few months, Rajkov thought. Then Pavel Alexeyev, deputy commander of the Southwestern Theater, spoke.
I heard rumors, he said, but that bad?
Yes. We have sufficient POL supplies for 12 months of normal operations, or enough for 60 days of war operations after a brief period of increased training activity.
At the cost, he didn't say, of crippling the national economy by mid-August. Alexeyev leaned forward and swatted himself with his bundle of branches. The action was strangely like a lion's swishing its tail. At 50, he was the second youngest officer there, a respected intellectual soldier and a fit, handsome man with the shoulders of a lumberjack. His intense, dark eyes squinted down through the rising cloud of steam.
Mid-June?
Yes, Rajkov said. We have that long to prepare our plans and our troops.
Sink Ground looked around the room.
Already the ceiling had become partially obscured by a mist.
I presume we are here so that we may speak frankly among ourselves, no?
This is so, Pavel Leonidovich, Rajkov replied, not the least surprised that Alexeyev had been the first to speak.
Sink Ground had carefully advanced the man's career over the last decade. He was the only son of a hard-charging tank general of the Great Motherland War, one of the many good men pensioned off during the bloodless purges under Nikita Khrushchev in the late 1950s.
Comrades,
Alexeyev stood, climbing slowly down the benches to the marble floor.
I accept everything Marshal Rajkov has told us, but 4 months. 4 months in which we may be detected. 4 months in which we may lose all the element of surprise. Then what may happen?
No, we have a plan already for this. Zhukov 4. Instant mobilization. We can all be back to our command posts in 6 hours. If we are going to conduct a surprise attack, then let us make it one no one can detect in time. 72 hours from now.
Again the only sound in the room was that of the water flashing to steam on the dun-colored bricks. Then the room erupted with noise. Zhukov 4 was the winter variant of a plan which hypothesized discovery of NATO's intention to launch a surprise attack of its own on the Warsaw Pact. In such a case, standard Soviet military doctrine was the same as anyone else's. The best defense is a good offense. Preempt the NATO armies by attacking at once with the Category A mechanized divisions in East Germany.
But we are not ready, objected Sinquest.
His was the Point Command with headquarters in Berlin, the single most powerful military command in the world. An attack into West Germany was primarily his responsibility. Alexeyev held up his hands.
Neither are they. In fact, they are less ready than we, he said reasonably.
Look, consider our intelligence data. 14% of their officers are on holidays. They are coming off a training cycle, true, but because of it, much of their equipment will be down for maintenance, and many of their senior officers will be away in their respective capitals for consultations, just as we are now. Their troops are in winter quarters on a winter routine. This is the time of year for maintenance and paperwork. Physical training is curtailed. Who wants to run in the snow, eh? Their men are cold and drinking more than usual. This is our time to act. We all know that historically the Soviet fighting man performs at his best in winter, and NATO is at its lowest state of readiness.
But so are we, you young fool, Sink Western Theater growled back.
We can change that in 48 hours, Alexeyev countered.
Impossible, observed West's deputy, careful to back up his boss.
To reach our maximum readiness will take some months, Alexeyev agreed.
His only chance to carry his point with his seniors was to reason with them. He knew that he was almost certainly doomed to failure, but he had to try.
It will be difficult, if not impossible, for us to conceal it. As Marshal Roshkov told us, Pavel Leonidovich, we are promised political and diplomatic maskirovka, a general pointed out. I have no doubt that our comrades in the KGB and our skillful political leadership will perform miracles. The room just might have functioning bugs after all. But is it not asking too much to expect that the imperialists, as much as they fear and hate us, as active as their agents and spy satellites are, will fail to note a doubling of our training activity? We know that NATO increases its readiness when we go into major unit training, and their preparedness will automatically be increased by their own spring training cycles. If we continue our training beyond the normal pattern, they will be even more alert. Achieving full combat readiness requires that we do too many things out of the ordinary. If nothing else, East Germany is rife with Western spies. NATO will notice. NATO will react. They will meet us on the border with everything in their collective arsenals. If, on the other hand, we attack with what we have, now, we have the advantage. Our men are not off skiing in the fucking Alps. Zhukov 4 is designed to cycle from peace to war in 48 hours. There is no way possible for NATO to react in so little time. They'll take 48 hours to get their intelligence information organized and presented to their ministers. By that time, our shells will be falling on the Fulda Gap, and our tanks will be advancing behind them. Too many things can go wrong. Cinquest rose so swiftly that the towel nearly came off his waist. His left hand grabbed downward, while his right fist shook at the younger man. What about traffic control? What about training our men in their new battle equipment? What about getting my frontal aviation pilots ready for combat operations against the imperialists? There, right there, is an insurmountable problem. Our pilots need at least a month of intensive training. And so do my tankers, and so do my gunners, and so do my riflemen. If you knew your job, they would be ready now, you worthless, whore-chasing son of a bitch, Alexeyev thought, but did not dare to say aloud. Cinquest was a man of 61 who liked to demonstrate his manly prowess, boasted of it, to the detriment of his professional duties. Alexeyev had heard that story often enough, whispered jovially in this very room. But Cinquest was politically reliable. Such is the Soviet system, the younger general reflected. We need fighting soldiers, and what do we get with which to defend the Rodina? Political reliability. He remembered bitterly what had happened to his father in 1958. But Alexeyev did not allow himself to begrudge the party its control of the armed forces. The party was the state, after all, and he was a sworn servant of the state. He had learned these truisms at his father's knee. One more card to play. Comrade General, you have good officers commanding your divisions, regiments, and battalions. Trust them to know their duties. It couldn't hurt to wave the standards of the Red Army, Alexeyev reasoned. Roshkov stood, and everyone in the room strained to hear his pronouncement. What you say has merit, Pavel Leonidovich, but do we gamble with the safety of the motherland? He shook his head, quoting doctrine exactly, as he had been doing for too many years. No. We rely on surprise, yes. On the first weighted blow to blast open a path for the daring thrust of our mechanized forces. And we will have our surprise. The Westerners will not wish to believe what is happening. And with the Politburo soothing them even as we prepare the first blow, we will have our strategic surprise. The West will have, perhaps, 3 days, four at most, to know what is coming. And even then they will not be mentally prepared for us. The officers followed Roshkov from the room to rinse the sweat from their bodies with cold water showers. 10 minutes later, refreshed and dressed in full uniform, the officers reassembled in a second-floor banquet room. The waiters, many of them KGB informers,
noted the subdued mood and quiet conversations that frustrated their efforts to listen in. The generals knew that KGB's Lefortovo prison was a bare kilometer away.
"Our plans?" Sink Southwest asked his deputy.
"How many times have we played this war game?" Alexeyev responded.
"All the maps and formulae we have examined for years. We know the troop and tank concentrations. We know the routes, the highways, the crossroads that we must use, and those that NATO will use. We know our mobilization schedules and theirs. The only thing we don't know is whether our carefully laid plans will, in fact, work. We should attack at once. Then the unknowns will work against both sides equally."
"And if our attack goes too well, and NATO relies on a nuclear defense?" the senior officer asked.
Alexeyev acknowledged the importance and grave unpredictability of the point.
"They might do that anyway. Comrade, all of our plans depend heavily on surprise, no?
A mixture of surprise and success will force the West to consider nuclear weapons."
"Here you are wrong, my young friend," Sink Southwest chided. "The decision to use nuclear weapons is political. To prevent their use is also a political exercise for which time is required."
"But if we wait over 4 months, how can we be assured of strategic surprise?" Alexeyev demanded.
"Our political leadership has promised it."
"The year I entered Frunze Academy, the party told us the date on which we would surely have true communism in our lifetime. A solemn promise. That date was 6 years ago."
"Such talk is safe with me, Pasha. I understand you. But if you do not learn to control your tongue—"
"Forgive me, Comrade General.
We must allow for the chance that surprise will not be achieved. In combat, despite the most careful preparations, risks cannot be avoided," Alexeyev quoted from the syllabus of the Frunze Academy. "Attention must therefore be given, and the most detailed plans prepared for every reasonable exigency of the overall operation. For this reason, the unsung life of a staff officer is among the most demanding of those honored to serve the state."
"You have the memory of a kulak, Pasha," Sink Southwest laughed, filling his deputy's glass with Georgian wine. "But you are correct.
Failure to achieve surprise means that we are forcing a campaign of attrition on a vast scale, a high-technology version of the 14-18 war."
"Which we will win," Sink ground, sat down next to Alexeyev.
"Which we will win," Alexeyev agreed.
All Soviet generals accepted the premise that the inability to force a rapid decision would force a bloody war of attrition that would grind each side down equally. The Soviets had far more reserves of men and material with which to fight such a war, and the political will to use them. "If and only if we are able to force the pace of battle, and if our friends in the Navy can prevent the resupply of NATO from America. NATO has war stocks of materiel to sustain them for roughly 5 weeks. Our pretty expensive fleet must close the Atlantic."
"Maslov," Rashkov beckoned to the commander-in-chief of the Soviet Navy.
"We wish to hear your opinion of the correlation of forces in the North Atlantic."
"Our mission?" Maslov asked warily.
"If we fail to achieve surprise in the West, Andrei Petrovich, it will be necessary for our beloved comrades in the Navy to isolate Europe from America," Rushkov pronounced.
He blinked hard at the response.
"Give me a division of airborne troops, and I can fulfill that task," Maslov responded soberly.
He held a glass of mineral water, and had been careful to avoid drink on this cold February night.
"The question is whether our strategic stance at sea should be offensive or defensive. The NATO navies, above all the United States Navy, is a direct threat to the Rodina. It alone has the aircraft and aircraft carriers with which to attack the homeland, at the Kola Peninsula. In fact, we know that they have plans to do exactly that."
"So what?" Sink Southwest observed.
No attack on Soviet soil is to be taken lightly, of course, but we will take severe losses in this campaign, no matter how brilliantly we fight it. What matters is the final outcome.
If the Americans succeed in attacking Kola, they effectively prevent our closure of the North Atlantic. And you are wrong to shrug off these attacks. American entry into the Barents Sea will constitute a direct threat to our nuclear deterrent forces, and could have more dire consequences than you imagine.
Admiral Maslov leaned forward.
On the other hand, if you persuade Stavka to give us the resources to execute Operation Polar Glory, we can seize the combat initiative and dictate the nature of operations in the North Atlantic on our chosen terms.
He held up a closed fist.
By doing this, we can first, he raised a finger, prevent an American naval attack against the Rodina. Second, another finger, use the majority of our submarine forces in the North Atlantic Basin, where the trade routes are, instead of keeping them on passive defense. And third, a final finger, make maximum use of our naval aviation assets. At one stroke, this operation makes our fleet an offensive rather than a defensive weapon.
And to accomplish this, you need only one of our Guards' air rifle divisions?
Outline your plan for us, please, Comrade Admiral, Alexeyev said. Maslov did so over a period of 5 minutes. He concluded, "With luck, we will with one blow give the NATO navies more than they can deal with, and leave us with a valuable position for post-war exploitation.
Better to draw their carrier forces in and destroy them." Sinquest joined the discussion.
Maslov responded,
"The Americans will have 5 or 6 carriers available to use against us in the Atlantic. Each one carries 58 aircraft that can be used in an air superiority or nuclear strike role, aside from those used for fleet defense. I submit, comrade, that it is in our interest to keep those ships as far from the Rodina as possible."
"Andrei Petrovich, I am impressed," Rajkov said thoughtfully, noting the respect in Alexeyev's eyes as well.
Polar Glory was both bold and simple. "I want a full briefing on this plan tomorrow afternoon. You say that if we can allocate the resources, success in this venture is highly probable?"
"We have worked on this plan for 5 years, with particular emphasis on simplicity. If security can be maintained, only 2 things need go right for success to be achieved."
Rajkov nodded.
"Then you will have my support."
Chapter 4 Maskarovka 1 Moscow, RSFSR. The foreign minister entered stage left, as he always did, and walked to the lectern with a brisk step that belied his 60 years. Before him was a mob of reporters arrayed by the Soviet guards into their respective groups, the print press grasping at their pads and backed up by their photographers, the visual media arrayed in front of their portable Klieg lights. The foreign minister hated the damn things, hated the people in front of them. The Western press, with its lack of manners, always prying, always probing, always demanding answers that he need not give to his own people. How odd, he thought, while looking up from his notes, that he often had to speak more openly to these paid foreign spies than to members of the party central committee. Spies. Exactly what they were. They could be manipulated, of course, by a skilled man with a collection of carefully prepared disinformation, which was precisely what he was about to do. But on the whole, they were a threat because they never stopped doing what it was they did. It was something the foreign minister never allowed himself to forget, and the reason he did not hold them in contempt. Dealing with them always held potential danger. Even while being manipulated, they could be dangerous in their quest for information. If only the rest of the Politburo understood.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he began, speaking in English, "I will be making a brief statement, and I regret that I cannot answer any questions at this time. A full handout will be given to everyone as you leave. That is, I think they are ready by now." He gestured to a man at the back of the room, who nodded emphatically.
The foreign minister arranged his papers one more time and began to speak with the precise diction for which he was known.
"The President of the United States has often asked for deeds, not words, in the quest for control of strategic arms. As you know, and to the disappointment of the entire world, the ongoing arms negotiations in Vienna have made no significant progress for over a year, with each side blaming the other for the lack of it. It is well known by peace-loving people the world over that the Soviet Union has never wished for a war, and that only a madman would even consider nuclear war a viable policy option in our modern world of overkill, fallout, and nuclear winter."
"Damn," muttered AP Bureau Chief Patrick Flynn.
The Soviets scarcely acknowledged nuclear winter, and had never mentioned the concept in so formal a setting. His antennae were already twitching at whatever there was in the wind.
"The time has come for substantive reductions in strategic arms. We have made numerous, serious, sincere proposals for real arms reductions. And despite this, the United States has proceeded with the development and deployment of its destabilizing, openly offensive weapons. The MX First Strike Missile, so cynically called the Peacekeeper, the advanced Trident D-5 First Strike Sea-Launched Ballistic Missile, two separate varieties of cruise missiles whose characteristics conspire to make arms control verification almost totally impossible. And, of course, the so-called Strategic Defense Initiative, which will take offensive strategic weapons into space. Such are America's deeds."
He looked up from his notes and spoke with irony.
"And through it all, America's pious words demand Soviet deeds. Starting tomorrow, we will see once and for all if America's words are to be believed or not. Starting tomorrow, we will see how great a difference there is between America's words about peace and Soviet deeds for peace. Tomorrow, the Soviet Union will put on the table at Vienna a proposal to reduce existing arsenals of strategic and theater nuclear weapons by 50%. This reduction to be accomplished over a period of 3 years from ratification of the agreement, subject to on-site verification conducted by third-party inspection teams whose composition will be agreed upon by all signatories. Please note that I say all signatories. The Soviet Union invites the United Kingdom, the French Republic, and," he looked up, "the People's Republic of China to join us at the negotiating table."
The explosion of flashbulbs caused him to look away for a moment.
"Ladies and gentlemen, please,"
he smiled, holding his hand up to shield his face.
"These old eyes are not up to such abuse as this, and I have not memorized my speech, unless you want me to continue in Russian."
There was a wave of laughter, then a sprinkling of applause at the jibe. The old bastard was really turning on the charm, Flynn thought, furiously taking notes. This was potential dynamite. He wondered what would come next, and he especially wondered what the precise wording on the proposal was. Flynn had covered arms talks before, and knew all too well that general descriptions of proposals could grossly distort the nuts and bolts details of the real issues to be negotiated. The Russians couldn't be this open. They just couldn't be.
"To proceed."
The foreign minister blinked his eyes clear.
"We have been accused of never making a gesture of our good faith. The falsehood of the charge is manifest, but this evil fiction continues in the West. No longer. No longer will anyone have cause to doubt the sincerity of the Soviet people's quest for a just and lasting peace. Beginning today, as a sign of good faith, which we challenge the United States and any other interested nation to match, the Soviet Union will remove from service an entire class of nuclear-powered missile submarine. These submarines are known to the West as the Yankee class. We call them something else, of course.
he said with an ingenuous grin that drew another wave of polite laughter.
20 of the vessels are presently in service, each carrying 12 sea-launched ballistic missiles. All active members of the class are assigned to the Soviet Northern Fleet based on the Kola Peninsula. Beginning today, we will deactivate these vessels at a rate of one per month. As you know,